Blog Talk Radio.
Day after Halloween, everyone. That's an official holiday, right? The day after Halloween.
Today is the Day of the Dead.
Oh, is it?
Yes. So, yeah, happy Day of the Dead.
Oh, we should have had, like, a Romero-themed show then. that would have made perfect sense.
We got George Romero call in.
I would love to talk to him.
I would do that. I've been wanting to talk to him ever since we've done the show, so.
What is his hometown? Is it Pittsburgh? Is that where he's from?
That is correct. Pittsburgh is where all the action is, yeah.
Yeah, he kind of put Pittsburgh on the map with Night of the Living Dead.
I thought the Steelers did that. Wait a second. All right, never mind. I'm going to shut up now.
I don't know if the Steelers are particularly scary this season or not. I haven't been following them. But no other high-profile filmmakers out of Pittsburgh.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I could do some research and find out.
That's not that important.
Okay, thank you. I'm gonna shut up for the rest of the show. All right, not that that's possible, but all right, never mind.
We got a nice show tonight. HBO has this documentary that premieres on Tuesday night.
Mm-hmm.
It's unprecedented access to the Obama campaign while they were campaigning
mm-hmm.
for the presidency, and it's an interesting story behind that. We'll have the directors of that documentary, Amy Rice and Alicia Sams, with us.
Right.
And then a little bit later on the show, we're talking about Pittsburgh, another indie film community that was put on the map a couple of years ago by our guest on Wednesday night, Mark Borchardt.
That's right.
American movie fame.
Mm-hmm.
This gentleman who cast Mark in his movie Modus Operandi is also a Milwaukeean. And he's has a big, strong, independent filmmaking spirit, and he's going to share it with us. At the top of the next hour, Frankie Latina will be with us.
Okay, cool.
And in between, we're going to talk about all the goings-on, movie news, and we've seen many new movies between the two of us.
Right.
So let's talk about a couple of those right now, and then
okay.
we'll tease off into some others later. First of all, I went to the theater on Friday afternoon, and I watched This Is It.
How was it?
You know, it's pretty amazing. You just sit in awe of his talent because it was such an awesome talent.
Oh, you know, it was. There's no doubt about that.
And that was really what I got from it. It was a big spectacle, that show would have been. I know that Armand White, critic of the New York Press, that I normally disagree with, I agreed with most of his review on this particular film, and he has a big interest in Michael Jackson. He's actually just penned a book on Michael Jackson that he's publishing independently.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I did not know that. Okay.
He's made statements like, you know, that black and white is better than most films, the video. He said that Vincent Price's work and the Thriller song is the finest of his career. Stuff like that. But in the review, he said this is the best concert film ever made. It's a good companion piece to the Talking Heads, the Demi's Stop Making Sense concert film.
Really?
I don't think it is, because first of all, it's not a concert.
It's rehearsal footage, right?
Yeah, I would say it's the best concert rehearsal film ever made.
Okay, yeah.
because Michael Jackson is at maybe 50-60% while he's rehearsing the show. I mean, he's saving full energy for the actual performance.
Right.
But still, it's better than most. It's more awe-inspiring than most at their 100%. But it gets kind of trying. It's a full 2-hour movie, and it loses some steam for me. But the music is obviously great and infectious. His rendition of Human Nature, which is almost a cappella.
I think I saw that on one of your status updates. You said that was the highlight for you on Facebook.
That was the highlight for me. And ironically, it is the most stripped down of all the presentations of the songs in the movie. And for my money, the most honest. And that's where I really saw Michael, the artist, and what he had to bring as an artist and not necessarily as a P.T. Barnum showman.
Right.
Yeah, so that's why I preferred that. So all in all, it's a worthwhile movie. Didn't perform as well as I'm sure Sony had hoped.
Yeah, but it's still, you know, now going on, because they gave this really big inflation. They, a couple of weeks ago, was like, oh, it will make $250 million in 5 days. And, you know, I know they say they obviously, you know, lowered that. But it's still, for a concert film or rehearsal film, whatever you want to call it, it did very well.
Yeah.
I don't think you can. I don't care who you are. I know Sony's might be disappointed, or other people, other the rival studios are like happy. That's just still a good number for that kind of movie. Let's be honest. That's a very good number.
Yeah, and I don't know its worldwide gross. I know that in the States it's pulled in a little over $30 million in the past 5 days, and they paid $60 million for it, and they said that they've spent only $10 million to market it. Even so, it released worldwide on the same day.
Yeah.
And then I'm sure when you take into account DVD and everything like that, I think this is one of those movies that'll be a much bigger hit on DVD than the big screen.
Oh, yeah. I think this was made for DVD and Blu-ray, and I think it will be. It's like one of those things that people will keep going back to.
Mm-hmm.
I really do believe that. It's not in the, our good friend Jason O'Brien, worldwide this weekend was $101 million. That's a really good number.
Yeah.
I mean, just because it didn't get the numbers they originally projected, it's still a good number.
And, you know, I think it's keeping in line with his popularity internationally as opposed to domestically. I mean, obviously there's great interest and great fan base here in the U.S., but, I mean, the last big concert I saw of his was in Bucharest. And you know, it was like the Beatles. People were crying and passing
right
out. You know, there's a big international fan base. So it was smart to release it worldwide on the same day, and that collective buzz that hit all at once all throughout the world. Other movie, should we talk about Antichrist?
You should. I didn't, you know, I didn't get it. He didn't show. Now, I was in two places. My house and IFC On Demand didn't get it, and the hotel I was at last night for a friend's wedding didn't get it. So you got it. So tell us about it.
How was the wedding, by the way?
The wedding was a lot of fun. I had a good time. It was really nice to just chill out and hang out with a lot of old friends and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a good time. A really good time. Very relaxing.
Yeah. Well, Antichrist was not a good time. This was the Lars von Trier film. I don't know. Did it get a rating? Did it go unrated?
I think I can't imagine. Just from everything I've read and every review I've read, I think it is unrated. I could be mistaken about that. But here, while you're talking, I'll go look that up.
Okay, and look up Pittsburgh at the same time. So I saw this. First of all, we've talked about it on the show after the Cannes premiere of this film that caused a great scandal of the lengths of depravity depicted in this movie. I'm not going to go into detail now, but it's, you know, it's very physical, sexual carnage,
mm-hmm.
kind of torturous, the likes of which you've never seen before in a movie. And I can honestly say that's true. They hired adult film stars to double as the actors. So you do see everything. You see penetration. You see everything. You see all the sadistic things they do to one another.
Wow.
And I halfway through it, I said, how can this movie include all of those elements and still be so boring?
Oh, it's one of those? Okay. All right. That doesn't surprise me, sadly.
I kind of expected it from von Trier because, yes, he's a daring filmmaker. He's also, for my money, a very pretentious one. And this movie is, it's really, when you boil down to it, at its essence, it's about grief and the different stages of grief. And it's not, there's nothing to latch on to. I didn't feel anything for the characters while I admired the lengths that they went to, especially the lead actress. She's
Charlotte Gainsbourg. It's not rated,
yeah.
By the way. It is not. It's
okay.
A not rated film.
Okay, she is monumental in this movie, what she had to play. And of course, Willem Dafoe's in it. He's always very good. The movie was just a pretentious bore to me.
All right, let me ask you this. Have you seen Dogville or Manderley?
I've seen a lot of Dogville, yeah.
Okay, is it more pretentious than that?
It's probably on the same level.
Okay.
It's on the same level of self-consciously artsy, deep without depth.
right. No, I understand what you're coming. But he made that great trilogy. Dancer in the Dark. And then after that, we get Dogville and Manderley, which I know there are people, Dogville has its fans, but I just couldn't get into it. I even saw that in the theater, and I couldn't. And I did like his film after that. He made another film after those two, Boss of It All, which I thought was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But it sounds like this one is he really goes off the deep end in this one.
Oh, it really does. And he strikes me as a man that believes his own BS.
Really?
And that's probably his downfall.
So he believes his own hype, essentially, like which is everyone's downfall.
Yeah. Well, he essentially is his hype.
Okay.
He self-generates it.
I remember early on, I remember in like college watching Zentropa, and I found that interesting. And then later on, I found Epidemic, and there's of course The Kingdom. You know, he made very thought-provoking films. It wasn't just pretentious to be the sake of pretentious. And then something happens in the turn of the century, I guess. You can even say it starts, even though as much as I love Dancer in the Dark, you could say it starts there, maybe. But it definitely is prevalent in Dogville and especially in Manderley, that pretentiousness.
It was written in a dark place, a dark depression that he went through, Antichrist was. And it really, there's a lot of despair, a lot of hatred, a lot of wanting to shock yourself into a state of alertness present in the script, I guess. But there's nothing in it that I cared very much about, except the photography. My God, it's beautifully shot. Anthony Dodd Mantle, who just shot Slumdog Millionaire.
Right.
It's gorgeously shot.
Different gears there. I mean, my God.
Yeah. It gets more and more surreal in the shooting style, and sometimes, you know, a little too pretty. I mean, sometimes it looks like a Zales commercial or something.
Zales.
Oh, my God. Dun, 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 dun. Anyway, that was my impression of that. I would not recommend it unless you just want to see for yourself how far this movie goes. It goes all the way. It doesn't push the envelope. It obliterates it. So there you have that.
Wow.
So you saw a couple of films.
I did. I saw two films since the last time we've been on the air. The first one is the new film from with Peter Sarsgaard, An Education, which is really a tour de force performance from Carey Mulligan as Jenny. She plays a school student in 1960s London who's, you know, once he's trying, you know, her parents wanted to go to Oxford and everything's. And then she meets Peter Sarsgaard's character, and he, you know, offers her a different world, a different life. And it's a very beautiful coming-of-age story. But the trailer is kind of misleading because the film takes a lot of different turns.
Mm-hmm.
And for the better. I mean that in the best possible way. This is a very powerful film about a child's relationship to their parents and to their lover and to what's expected of them. It's very powerful, and I do think that Carey Mulligan is a shoo-in for Best Actress, and I would like to say that I think, you know, during the summer, I guess the early part of the summer, I had said that what a disappointing year this was, but when I've gone back and looked at it, it's been quite a banner year for actress performances for some reason. I'm looking back.
Yeah, that's good.
No, Sunshine Cleaning, 500 Days of Summer, Away We Go, this one, Coco Before Chanel, and it looks like, and you know, before we saw this, the trailers before this film, we got Nine, mm-hmm. Up in the Air, Broken Embraces with Penelope Cruz, mm-hmm. Just everything. There's just so many good movies coming out. Yeah, I can't get over how many good
yeah.
movies are coming out. But there, and the Young Victoria with Emily Blunt looks good, and you know, just a lot of great films coming.
They also say with the expansion of the Best Picture category to 10 now that An Education stands a good shot of a nomination in that.
Now, let me ask you about that. Now, is that purely for ratings, you think? I don't
yeah.
think this conversation.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't seem fair. You're going to nominate these pictures, but then what about then these guys, the people get shut out of the actress or acting or the writing or the director category. So, but I guess it's just, I understand it. I understand why they did it.
Well,
for the smaller movie, it means more awareness. That's
well, there's an article out. There's an article out today. A lot of Academy members are furious over the expansion to 10. They weren't notified. They weren't consulted. It was just a decision made, and for ratings,
right.
And to appease big studio releases. And people like Jane Campion said, "Well, the non-big studio releases are better." So
she's right.
Yeah, so it seems to be that the broadcast, I think even Michael Sheen had a quote where he said, it seems a lot less special now to be nominated for Best Picture when you have 10. What is less special to me is that they're shutting out the honorary awards,
mm-hmm.
which are usually
yeah.
the most human moments of the evening.
Yeah.
We won't see them anymore. We won't see Lauren Bacall or Gordon Willis.
Right.
And that's a big
you
know, slap in the face to them.
Yeah, it is. You're absolutely right. And speaking of Jane Campion, I hope Abby Cornish is recognized for Bright Star. I
yeah.
really do. That's a magnificent performance.
Yeah, I think it stands a good shot of.
Yeah.
So An Education, and you saw another one. You saw.
I did see another one because we couldn't get Antichrist because
Hideous Interviews or what? What
brief,
was it?
Brief Interviews with Hideous Men, John Krasinski from The Office, his directorial
mm-hmm.
debut, and it's based on a David Foster Wallace book, and mm-hmm. it's got everyone's in this, Dominic Cooper, Lou Taylor Pussy, Ben Gingerbard from...
did you just say?
Lou Taylor Pussy from The Informers, and...
His last name is Pussy?
No, P-U-C-C-I, I think it's P-U...
Pussy.
Pussy.
Okay.
I didn't think, you think, oh, man, you just want to frame me. You just want to get me
yeah,
in trouble.
Yeah, so go on.
You just want to get me in trouble. But everyone's in this movie. I mean, Timothy
yeah.
Hutton's in this movie. I mean, he's having a good year between this and Limelight.
Uh-huh.
He's having a really good year. Max Minghella's in this film. Will Arnett. And it's not for everyone, though. It is, because it is based on a David Foster Wallace novel. And as everyone knows, he sadly committed suicide a year and a half ago. It ends with a quote from him. I don't remember what the exact quote it was, but it was about relationships, and it was the kind of thing that said, oh, my God, I can't believe they ended it on that note.
Mm.
But it's a very good independent film, and it's a very good directorial debut from Krasinski, because it's not what you would expect from the guy from The Office. And I'm a very strong proponent of his acting in Away We Go.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think, this is a worthwhile film. It's not for everyone. I think it's kind of like if you did a double feature of this and The Informers, it's a good thing about just like the dark side of human nature. But I think it's worthwhile checking out. I really
okay.
do. I enjoy it. I don't know if enjoyed is the right word, but
you appreciated it.
I did appreciate what it was trying to do.
Okay. All right. We got some movie news coming up, including casting news on the fourth Mad Max, which is a go.
It is.
After all these years.
Mm-hmm.
Minus Mad Mel.
Nothing got Mel, but his new film looks good.
I did see the trailer of that. It looks
angry. It looks like Taken with Mel Gibson.
Yeah. It looks like your standard Martin Campbell thriller to me, but it looks good for him.
Yeah.
And another trailer, Invictus, I saw that, and
mm-hmm.
they premiered the 3-minute Avatar trailer on the NFL shows today. the largest viewing audience for a trailer in history.
Did you like it?
I didn't see that.
Okay.
I just know that they premiered it.
I didn't see that.
I did see the latest trailer for Avatar, which I think is, you're right, a great improvement over the previous.
Yeah, I really do. I think you have the upper hand now.
Yeah, well, thank you. So here's my here's another film that I saw recently, By the People, The Election of Barack Obama, which premieres Tuesday the 3rd on HBO. It's a great eye-opening look at, first of all, how a campaign runs, in terms of a portrait of Obama, how calm and collected he is in the middle of a storm that would completely jolt anyone else. He takes everything in stride. It really is true, because they had unprecedented access to Obama when they made this film.
That's right.
And, you know, every scandal that came up in the course of it, he just kind of let it wash, you know, brush it off his shoulder. It was a man of amazing composure. You know, I really, really enjoyed the documentary. It was fascinating to me to watch. And the thing that was most inspiring about it was the movement of volunteers and campaign workers being excited about making a difference, being excited about their candidate. And it really is as much about them as it is about Obama and how they secured his victory with their passion and their hard work.
Right.
I wouldn't say it's a whitewash movie, but it's not one that really covers a lot of the more scandalous sides of campaigning.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't really cover much of the venom coming from, you know, Obama's opponents. It doesn't cover a lot of the different issues that came up during the campaign. So, but what it does very well, which I already described. But we did get a chance to speak to the directors of the film, By the People, The Election of Barack Obama. And the directors are Miss Amy Rice and Alicia Sams. And here they are talking about the project.
My name is Lorenzo and I'm 9 years old. I'm a volunteer with the Obama campaign. How are you?
Where's Diana?
Who's Diana?
Obama is a candidate running for president.
No, not Diana, Obama.
Well, he's a candidate running for president.
He's a candidate running for president of the United States of America.
What do you think of Barack Obama?
I don't know much about the guy, to be honest with you.
I have no clue who that is.
You don't?
I have no clue who that is.
Wait, is he African American?
Yeah.
Okay. That'd be really cool if he was our next president, then.
Of course, after Bush, anybody can be president. I can be president.
The strength of Obama's campaign is his laboratory for organizing.
The momentum has definitely shifted.
I haven't done this since campaign for Bobby Kennedy back in the mid-60s.
Do you think this country is ready to elect first African American?
No. This is a close race. We're on the verge of making history.
We weren't going to win the primary. How could this be? We're going to lose.
We have to win.
I'm so proud of you, honey.
I don't think that America's ready for it yet.
We think McCain's in real trouble.
This is the most important election of our life.
Unbelievable. We are the ones we've been waiting for.
Hope you have a wonderful day.
Back in 2004, I received a call from my brother in Oklahoma, and he told me on the day that Barack was giving the keynote address. And he said, hey, you know, Amy, you got to watch this guy, Barack Obama, give the keynote address at the convention tonight. And I remember saying, Andy, his name sounds so weird. Who is that? He's like, I know. He's like, just listen, just watch, because he's the future of the Democratic Party. And I remember watching the speech and listening to it and being very impressed with what he had to say. You know, it was very new and very different. And I felt like, you know, this is the first time a politician was speaking to my generation. Mm-hmm. And so then I went out and I bought his book, Dreams from My Father, the next day, and, you know, and read it and was really taken with his story. And so then, you know, and that's when I started thinking, wow, this guy could be the first African-American president, and that would make a great documentary. And so I pitched the idea to Alicia, who I'd worked with here in New York in the documentary film world, and she immediately got it and said, that's a great idea. Don't tell anybody. And and also I knew Edward Norton and Stuart Blumberg and Bill Migliori at Class 5 Films, and I pitched the idea to them, and they immediately got it and came on board, and we got to work.
You know, a million things have to go right in order for a million things not to go wrong. And
yeah.
So I'm curious, you had this faith in that that how it's going to turn out, but obviously you didn't know. So, I mean, what was that like through those 2 years of, following the campaign, particularly since, now that, used to be campaigns were a year, but, now campaigns are 2 years. I mean, so what was that grueling experience like, and did you ever waver in your, what you'd gotten yourself into?
Well, there was, the early kind of months in Iowa, the summer and fall, there was no certainty at all to where it was going to go and if he would, how far he would make it in Iowa. But we were learning so much and seeing so much and sort of developing these really, really interesting characters that at that point, I don't know, I wasn't worried that we were sort of doing this for nothing. It got a little sort of in the fall when it wasn't all sunny and beautiful anymore. It got a little more harrowing as to, like, what are we going to do if this doesn't go any farther? But we also had sort of in our hip pocket, we knew that if it didn't go past Iowa, we would just keep the footage and continue to follow him and see where he went. And then when he won Iowa, that was when I think we both felt like, okay, no matter what happens from here on in, we have a film to make now. You know, we could make a film just out of the Iowa experience and
right.
then what happened afterwards. But as far as just keeping, I mean, that's where it was really helpful to have the two of us in it together, I think, that we kind of kept each other going.
Yeah.
How, I'm curious, because in watching the film, how, it's interesting watching Obama in the film in that, throughout the campaign, a lot of stuff gets thrown at him. He goes, every high is almost immediately followed by a low, and, a praise is followed by, a criticism and so forth. And he never, wavers in his confidence. He seems to always be aware of what's going on, and nothing phases him, nothing rattles him. And so I'm curious how early on in y'all's observing of him realized that this guy does not seem to crack.
It's funny that you asked that, because that's, I always comment when people ask us what was the most surprising thing you learned about him, and it was just that, from day one, just how kind of calm and in his skin he is, even more so, I think, than what you see on television.
Mm-hmm.
I think, we would be backstage with him on nights, during the primaries, when he'd win by, a huge margin or lose by a huge margin, and he would just always be very even-keeled, and, which is great for a leader, but it's challenging when you're trying to make a dramatic documentary, and your character is just so even-keeled. but the Ronnie Chosen and Mike Blake's made up for it, so.
And what about the access? I mean, it looks like there was nothing off-limits, but was there anything like, this is, probably, where you got told, look, this is too personal a moment, can't get that, you can't have this or anything when it came to access as you were filming?
Well, we, for a lot of reasons, logistical and financial, we couldn't be everywhere all the time anyhow. So, there were definitely times when we didn't get where we wanted to be, and we had to realize that, we would look back and see, did we get some time with the kids? Did we get some time with Michelle, and so we ended up getting everything we wanted. But yeah, like we couldn't spend all the time we wanted with the kids on the campaign trail. You know what I mean? Like that was the one thing that they, I think, really wanted to protect was the sense of the family and to give those girls as normal a childhood as they possibly could have under the circumstances.
And there was the barbershop. Did you show it?
Oh yeah, and then the barbershop is kind of, I think, an interesting example in the film of when he just said, you know, I started shooting and then it started to attract attention, and that really was one of the places out in public where he could go and still be his same old self and
mm-hmm.
chat with the barbers and get his hair cut. And he's, you know, he was like, okay, stop shooting. This is my quiet time. This is my place.
Right.
And I'm
curious, you know, now that we know the outcome, it is interesting, like a lot of films that are, you know, a lot of fiction films that are based on true life events where we know the outcome and you create suspense even though we know how it's going to turn out. That happens here with this documentary. But, you know, now it's been a year. I'll ask you all this. Was there a moment late in the campaign when y'all finally realized, you know what, we actually, not only did we, were right in this gamble and doing this film, but we're actually going to have a victorious ending? I mean, did y'all have a moment where you're like, no, we got the upbeat ending?
Yeah. This is Amy. I think we always forget to do that. I can tell the difference between our voices. But I mean, I think we had the first time we had that moment was when he won Iowa. You know,
mm-hmm.
we felt very validated in our endeavor then. And then I don't, you know, I can't actually remember. You know, the primary was so up and down. I don't know if we ever completely felt confident that he was going to win. There were always so many crazy twists and turns, and we were just trying to keep up with the story and all the different subjects we were following. You know, even on election night, I don't even know if we weren't celebrating. That was our hardest night of shooting, actually.
Right.
So I don't know if that.
It didn't really hit me in that way until we went into the Oval Office, and I was like, wow, this is the end of our movie. We're shooting the end of our movie, and we're in the Oval Office. And I was like, oh, it worked.
Yeah, that was a great moment. And to walk into the West Wing and, you
right.
know, and see all of these people that we had been following for, you know, 2.5-3 years and Obama campaign headquarters, all over, you know, offices all over the country, and now here they were, you know, in the West Wing, and to walk into the Oval Office, and there was, you know, Barack and Gibbs and Axelrod, and, you know, looking at them and thinking, oh, how did we all end up here?
I just got two quick questions, and you bring up the Oval Office. I am curious, you know, obviously, you know, part of the White House and presidency is all part, is saturated in pop culture and movies and so forth, and I don't know if you all had been to the White House before this all started with tours or anything, but what is it like when you are, what was it like for y'all when y'all were in the White House and considering the circumstances you were there for? I gotta assume that it was humbles you a little.
It does, but you know, there's, the only time I'd ever been in the Oval Office before was on the set of An American President. So when you actually walk into the Oval Office, I sort of felt like I was on a movie set again. You know, it's so iconic, and then all of a sudden, there you are. But then the regular people's offices, like the press offices, are just sort of a rabbit warren of little rooms.
Right.
And you realize that, oh, wow, this is like a functioning building as well. That's kind of less
right.
glamorous than you expect. So it's
right.
interesting.
Yeah, my reference was the West Wing. I was like, this is like the West Wing. They copied the West Wing.
Well,
and everything else is tiny.
Yeah.
And my final question is obviously, has the Obama family seen it, and what was the response?
We know that that Barack saw it. He hasn't seen the final version of it.
Mm-hmm.
But when we were shooting the last day in the Oval Office, he said he'd seen the movie, and he said, I think it's great. He said, you know, when Ronnie Cho cried and Mike Blake cried, I cried. He said, I think you should put in more of them and less of me. And so, but that's, yeah, but I don't think the First Lady has seen it yet. But hopefully, I don't know, maybe they'll be watching on Tuesday night.
Yeah.
On each, yeah.
And it seems that that kind of modesty that you just mentioned, you know, more of them, less of me, is not fake. It seems that he is really that wanting to share the credit.
Well, yeah, I think it's also he had said it was interesting for him to get to know these people in our documentary because he didn't have time. He was always stumping out on the trail, so I think it was an insight into what was going on behind closed doors for him as well.
The day that we were in the barbershop, actually, I was talking to him about Iowa, and I think that was the last time he felt like he could really get that kind of one-on-one, get to know the organizers because he had the time, and he missed that part of the campaign. I think that he really appreciated what those kids were doing for him.
So. And, well, also he could relate because he used to be an organizer himself. So.
Right.
Sure, they'd have a lot to talk about.
Okay.
Good stuff.
Yeah, really. Amy Rice and Alicia Sams. What was that?
No, it was really good. I'm looking forward to watching that on Tuesday.
Yeah, it's a fascinating documentary. If you have any interest at all in the political process, that's one thing that I want to know from them because they traveled with this campaign for so long.
Right.
And it seems that it starts earlier and earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And it gets more and more brutal. And in a lot of cases, more and more...
starting now as we speak. I mean, it started really, I think, the day after the last election, to be honest with you.
Yeah, and bickering back and forth a lot of times about issues that things that don't really matter to try to discredit any of the candidates. I wanted to know from them what their feelings are about the democratic process after having gone through that and seeing it firsthand. I'd like to know. But it's a great one. Tuesday night, HBO.
What time on Tuesday night? 8 or 9?
I believe it's 9 Eastern.
Cool.
We'll check that out just to make sure before we go off here.
Okay.
In a few more minutes, we'll be welcoming on Frankie Latina, the writer director of Modus Operandi, which is certain to become the next big cult film.
Okay.
That's my prediction.
No, I think you're right. I'd like to talk about Fury Road, though. I really would, because this is at times exhilarating and disheartening.
You like to talk about what?
Fury Road, the fourth Mad Max
film. Oh, yeah, okay.
We know that, we know that Charlize Theron has been cast in it, and I don't know what part she's going to play, but what is the gentleman's name? Hardy is the last name. What's his first name? Is it John or is it Tom? Tom Hardy. I'm not.
I think it's Tom.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
And he's from the movie Bronson, which has gotten nothing but rave reviews. And I think he was in Rock and Roll as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What are your feelings about this?
Well, to be perfectly honest, I was never a huge fan of the Mad Max series.
Okay.
I mean, it wasn't something that I raced out to see, and I anticipated every installment.
Right.
I have seen all of them. I think The Road Warrior is my favorite of all of them.
Well, The Road Warrior is kind of one of those films, like, I guess it's like, you know, we went to go see that at the Avalon in 1982 when it opened, and it's one of those experiences you don't soon forget, and it's exhilarating, it's passionate, it's ecstatic. I mean, it's what Star Wars was to me 5 years before.
Mm-hmm.
I had never seen anything like it.
Yeah.
I remember when I lived in Los Angeles, Variety ran a story, this was in, I think, February of 2003, about Fury Road, that there was going to be a fourth Mad Max film. And this was still at a time when Mel Gibson was going to do it. This is while The Passion of the Christ was being made, and there was serious talk that he would be in it at some time, and also the other talk was that Heath Ledger would be his son.
Mm.
There was rumors that mm-hmm. was going to happen. And, you know, it was really interesting that Warner Brothers had even said, well, you know, the trilogy, altogether, all three films have grossed, like, what, it was $62 million. Not a lot by anyone's standards when you look at all three films. But I don't know how I feel about this. I really just don't know.
Well, for me, since I wasn't a huge fan of the original, it's not sacrilege to me.
No,
and I don't see how it can be sacrilege to anyone out there because George Miller is back. I mean, George Miller's putting it together.
Yeah, it's not sacrilege. It's just I don't. Here's my thing. I don't know if it's necessary.
What's necessary?
I know. Realize that it ends. I like the way the third one. Hell, I like the way the second one ends. You know, it's just him in the wasteland, and the third one is. Him, it ends in the wasteland. He's just alone. It's the way he's like the Clint Eastwood character in the Man with No Name movies. Or he's really like God, Alan Ladd and Shane. I mean, the Road Warrior is essentially the post-apocalyptic version of Shane.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that Mel Gibson would not return is not a surprise. He said he didn't want to come back. I think after The Passion of Christ, I'm surprised that he's acting at all, and that's why I am looking forward to Edge of Darkness, because I do enjoy watching him on screen. Regardless of his off-screen exploits, I do enjoy watching him act. I don't know.
He's a great movie star, but their choice to go with someone younger and exclude Mel Gibson leads me to believe that are they going – it's not a continuation – Is this something clumsy like the son of Mad Max or, I don't know.
I guess we'll know more in the weeks, months to come. But it's just, I unlike you, I do have a reverence for the old films. But it is, like you said, it's not sacrilege because George Miller's back. And if anyone understands the series, it's George Miller. So
mm-hmm.
If he's going to come back and do this, I think he has something up his sleeve that works.
Yeah, and I always enjoyed the structure of them. They're all structured similarly.
Mm-hmm.
And the closing car chase, which was always...
That's the big thing. That's the signature moment of these films. So he must have something. I mean, with a title like Fury Road, you must have something. Now... I'm curious, though. There's been speculation the last couple of weeks that the reason Charlize Theron was chosen was because of her performance in the flashbacks, I guess, of The Road.
Mm.
She is the wife and the mother in the flashbacks. And
right.
Well,
she's such an established actress that I don't see how they could see her in The Road and all of a sudden a light bulb goes off when she has so many other credits under her name. She's not
right.
A newbie. Yeah.
But I'm wondering if that was the thing. Let's put it like this one. No one does Armageddon like an Australian. George Miller, Peter Weir with The Last Wave, and to a lesser extent, The Picnic in Hanging Rock. And let's be honest, John Hillcoat with The Proposition, the Australian outback, it looks like a wasteland. And I think that's part of the appeal. So obviously, we'll know. I mean, I'm very curious what the story is, you know, the plot is of this one. And since it is on the fast track now with these two casting notices, I'm very curious what happens.
It's interesting. And this Tom Hardy, who got the lead as Mad Max, he's also in Inception, the new Christopher Nolan movie.
Yeah.
He's getting good roles. Mm-hmm. So this is another guy that's just taken off out of nowhere. And another movie called Warrior. Inception is a completely IMAX.
It is. He shot the whole thing in IMAX. Wow.
Yeah. It says right here, Inception, the IMAX experience. So I would hope so.
Yeah, okay.
So Nolan's got IMAX. That's good. Did you see this list that Scorsese compiled of his favorite horror movies?
I did. I actually did click on that. A couple of days ago. It was fascinating what some of the things he chose.
It is interesting. Some of the choices are, you could imagine, stuff like the original Haunting, I believe, was on there.
Yeah, no, that's a great film. That's a wonderful film.
Yeah, the one choice that, I think The Exorcist is on there, obviously. The one choice that really shocked me was The Entity.
Yeah, I saw that too. I was like, oh my God. Dude, I thought it was cool though. All right, here, I got it. It was at the Daily Beast he did this.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we got The Haunting at number one.
Mm-hmm.
Isle of the Dead, number two. Number
mm-hmm.
three, The Uninvited. And no, they don't put it all on one page. Sorry. Number four is the Entity.
Yeah. You remember the Entity, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I remember that, watching
that
when I was a kid.
For that movie on TV.
Yeah. Well, that stars Barbara Hershey. It's a 1983 film, paranormal kind of thing.
Yeah.
And he was quite close with Barbara Hershey for some time. I wonder how much that factored into it. Because I've never seen that movie in a best of horror film. I've never heard it spoken badly of.
No. But we got number five, we got Dead of Night. Number six, The Changeling, with, you know, that great, I like that George C. Scott movie. And
right.
Let me just go through it. And if you want to, just stop me when you want to talk about it. The Shining is number seven. The Exorcist is number eight. Oh, number nine is awesome. Night of the Demon. Oh, man, that's a good one. And let's see what else we got here. And just stop me when you want to talk. Please, stop me. Please.
You're doing good so far.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Oh, number 10. Oh, my God. Number 10 is awesome. The Innocents, which is like the original version of the others with Deborah Carr, I believe. And number 11 is Psycho.
Psycho. Yeah. Okay, so The Exorcist wasn't on there.
No, it was. It was.
Was.
Let me. Number 8. Number 8.
Okay. So The Shining and The Exorcist were on there.
Yeah. The Omen was not on there. So I'm the only person that really loves The Omen so much.
Yeah.
Oh, you know what else wasn't on there? Rosemary's Baby.
And I'm the only one that doesn't like The Shining.
Well, I mean, you know.
Yeah, Rosemary wasn't. Yeah.
Yeah. You either like Picasso or you don't. I don't know.
Let's see you. So that's an interesting list.
Yeah.
Now, Jerry, I know a movie that you're really looking forward to is Richard Kelly's new one.
So far, a story that's based on.
So far, I've read a complete pan.
Who panned it?
Oh, I can't recall who panned it. It was one of the first reviews out of the gate. That just said it was completely ineffectual.
Can I make, before I do that, you know, not only did I buy that book, but you know what other book I bought?
What?
I bought the Robert Altman oral biography.
Great.
No, I just wanted to say, and I'm looking at all the people that are interviewed in here, and I know this is not related to anything we're talking about. Everyone who loves movies should buy this book. It's just awesome.
You'll love it.
It's incredible. Okay, I'm sorry for that brief tangent.
And then Amy Taubin reviewed it and just raved about it.
Amy will be on my Christmas card list this year.
There's a sense of claustrophobia and impending doom created by precisely skewed camera angles and floating camera moves, lenses that compress or stretch space, loving attention to everyday places and objects under threat, a few shock edits, and a Hitchcock-worthy score by three members of Arcade Fire.
Oh, they're doing the music?
Yeah.
Oh, man, that's awesome. Okay. Can you just tell that this will be the most biased review in the history of film?
Right, yeah. So really, reviews across the board from what I've read thus far on this film. So that's going to be interesting. Polanski, do we want to talk about the latest with Polanski? He's been turned down for bail, so his lawyers tomorrow are entering a bail cash amount that they'd be willing to pay.
Okay.
And they say that it's very generous.
Wow, okay.
The worry is that he would flee.
Think he's going to flee at this point. I think he wants to get this over with.
Yeah.
I don't know what, you know, I honestly don't know what he's going through, but I think there's just a sense that he would want to get this over with at this time.
Yeah. Who knows? Joe Dante and Roger Corman are collaborating on a new project. I think it's a web project, a short web film series project.
That's what we've been, you know, with DJ Qualls last week and with Paul Schrader a couple of years ago. That's what we've been, you know, that's where it's going, so.
Mm-hmm.
So more power to him.
Francis's brother, August, passed on.
Yeah, I saw that.
It's also Nicolas Cage's father, Talia Shire's husband. He passed away, and for anyone that knows anything about Coppola's story, August factors very, very deeply into it.
Very, very big deal.
Yeah, it is. What's new with you? What are you looking forward to coming up?
Well, the box is this next weekend. Box. I mean, you don't have to be Matlock to know that. you like that? You like, yeah.
Matlock, really, that's great.
I'm really looking forward to, obviously, the Fantastic Mr. Fox and The Road. But I'm trying to think of other movies that come out this called in November. I'll be honest with you, if I miss 2012, that's all right. But I will probably see it. But he makes Michael Bay look restrained, and I never thought I'd say that, but he really does. We were talking about that last night. And that trailer where you see the destruction of Los Angeles is, I don't know, just because maybe I lived there for a year, just really hard to watch. But, no, there are other movies I'm looking at. I really want to see the Menesteric Goats very badly. I think I read the book a couple of years ago. That looks very good. I still want to see Antichrist, although I'm not, I don't know. I mean, if I want to torture myself, I guess. I'm curious about Gentleman Broncos. Are you curious about that at all, or...
I've been reading more and more about it, yeah.
What is your... Well, let me ask you this. What do you think of Napoleon Dynamite? That's, I guess, the question.
Napoleon Dynamite, I didn't take much to it. It was fine.
It was funny the first time I saw it, and in repeated viewings, it sort of diminished, I think, is like what I walk away. I mean, I appreciate what it's trying to do, but Nacho Libre, when I saw that with Jack Black a couple of years ago, it's a better idea than the execution is.
Right.
You know, that's how I feel about his films. I mean, this Gentleman Broncos, it's got the guy from Flight of the Conchords. It could be all right. All right, let me ask you, this is the elephant in the room here. This is a movie I'm very curious about, The Fourth Kind.
Yeah, I think that The Fourth Kind... Looks interesting, looks like it might work. It just really has the bad karma of coming out after Paranormal Activity.
Yeah, I think you're right. I couldn't agree more, yeah. But it's a scary trailer, for me at least, it's a scary trailer.
I think it could work. I think there'll be some interest out there for it. You know, we were talking about the Oscars earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're talking about Hosts. Obviously, they talk about Hosts, you know, the second the Oscar telecast goes off the air.
Right.
But Hugh Jackman nipped it in the bud, and he said, I'm not coming back.
He was a good host. I mean,
he was a terrific host, but he doesn't want to do it two times in a row. Because, I mean, he's obviously a big movie star. It's kind of a thankless thing to do.
Mm-hmm. It is.
It's nothing that would necessarily further his career at this point.
Right.
So the odds makers are tallying up who could fill the shoes this year. I think a website called We Are Movie Geeks reported that an inside source told them that Neil Patrick Harris is in as Oscar host.
He would be a great host.
Yeah.
He would be a really good host.
I'm on the record as saying I don't think that's going to happen.
Okay, but I still think it'd be a really good choice.
No, I like him and all the things that he does host.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be his full-time job now, hosting crap.
Right.
So, you know what the odds makers in Vegas say? Because there's a special unit that make odds in terms of nominations and who will win and that kind of thing. And so they're doing the same thing with who could possibly be announced as host. And their number one that they say has the best shot of being requested as host of the next Oscars is Billy Crystal.
That's a very strong possibility.
Would that be smart?
Well, he's done it before and he's done a good job.
Yeah,
I would say that. Trying to think though. Who else? All right, Jimmy Fallon. Why don't they get Jimmy Fallon to do it?
Yeah.
No, I know that's not going to work. That was kind of a joke, kind of serious, but that really felt.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Well, who would you like to see?
Well, there's also talk. There's obviously been talk about Justin Timberlake all this time. I don't know the direction they want to take. The producers, do they want to skew younger? Do they want to skew for what they know will work? In that case, Billy Crystal works.
Yeah.
He's not necessarily what would bring in the younger viewers, I don't think, but...
Well, let me ask, you know, Well, let's talk about this, because we haven't really talked about this, or maybe we have in a previous episode a while back. Yeah, there's all this talk about bringing in the younger viewers, but the country is skewing more older. The boomers, we have a very large boomer population that's retiring. I would think we might want to cater more towards them.
Yeah.
I know that's that sacrilege in the entertainment business where if you're over the age of 22, you don't exist. But I would think we really want to skew older than younger, because the younger kids really don't care about the award shows.
Yeah, I don't think they care about them, but TV in general does.
Oh, TV does. No, I know. I realize that. I mean, but I just, you know, this is a dangerous thing because when that announcement does for those 10 best picture, I'm very curious what's going to fill in those 5 extra slots.
Yeah.
I'm really.
And which ones, if all of them will be worthy or not.
Yeah.
You know?
There's some I think are. There's others that I don't think, but I don't know.
We're talking about Mad Max, and that it looks promising only at this stage of the game, only because it has George Miller's involvement.
Yeah, but how many kids do they know who George Miller even is?
Well, for movie people,
we know.
You're right. But in terms of somebody that can do justice to the material, might as well be the original guy.
Yeah.
So what do you think of the Alien prequel that Ridley Scott is doing?
Is Zoe Bell going to come back?
I don't know.
The last two, the Alien versus Predator films, have left such a sour taste in my mouth. This seems like such a desperate ploy for just cashing in on the name. I don't know if I really need to see how Ripley got her start. I don't mean to be negative that way, but this is what I was going to the conversation we had with Aaron about the Star Wars, the Clone Wars. I just think it's like you're going to the bottom of the barrel. You're scraping everything. You're sort of destroying the original good name of the property, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if we need to see Ripley, how she got her start. I think we see Ripley when we need to see Ripley. I don't know if there's anything before that we really need to see. I know that might be sacrilege to a lot of hardcore fans, but, you know, I know the reboots have been successful, have been a good idea, whether it be Batman or James Bond or Star Trek. I don't even know what you call Star Trek, whether it's a reboot or an alternative universe. But when we do these prequels, we take what was originally a great idea and we sort of, like, drag that good name through the mud.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, even if Ridley Scott comes back, I don't know if Alien can work.
The idea of Ridley Scott doing another big sci-fi movie
is
excites me.
But I don't know if they can recapture the magic. I really don't, Jamie.
Yeah, I mean, just trying to make a whole new magic. I mean, it takes place in 2070, where his original took place in 2100.
Wow.
He says everything's mapped out. They're just putting it to paper now in screenplay form. And Alien is scary. Also scary in staying within the Scott family.
Yeah.
Ridley's brother Tony is making a Chippendales movie.
That is very scary. I saw that.
I know. And you know what? I think it's right up his alley.
It probably is. It could be just as scandalous and as exciting as the Domino movie.
Well, yeah. I think the Chippendales movie could be a double feature with Top Gun easily.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. What was that Kenny Loggins song, Playing with the Boys? Wow. Yeah.
You're on a roll tonight, man.
Also, Roger Rabbit is being remade.
I've really been out of it. When was that announced?
They announced the two writers that they've hired to bring on for Roger Rabbit. Don't ask me who they are. I don't have them in front of me.
Okay, that's all right. I'm not going to ask you, but...
And J.J. Abrams has said that he is not coming back to direct a fourth Mission Impossible. So, we're about to bring on our next guest, but before we do, let me throw this out. When Tom Cruise devised this Mission Impossible series,
mm-hmm.
I thought he had a very good idea. He said, look, we're going to bring in different directors each installment. So each installment is going to have its own personal style and identity. I thought it worked like crazy with Brian De Palma in the original. I thought Brian De Palma a perfect fit to that Mission Impossible universe.
Yeah.
John Woo, it's just a little too much slow motion to be exciting for me. But it had some worthy moments in it. I thought J.J. Abrams
did. I agree with you. It does have some worthy moments.
Yeah, and I thought J.J. Abrams did a bang-up job with the third Mission Impossible. Who is a perfect director to be next in line for the fourth installment, do you think? Who fits that Mission Impossible mold?
I'll just go with Guy Ritchie.
Well, that would be interesting.
That'd be interesting. I just thought that's just the thing I thought. You know, at one time that was, you know, David Fincher and Joe Carnahan were being thought for the third film.
Well, if you recall, at one time Mission Impossible 2 was an Oliver Stone project.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Yeah, I went and saw Oliver Stone speak, and he talked about, you know, yeah, we're in talks. But what would that have been?
I think he could still do it. I would welcome that big time.
Yeah. So it's interesting to contemplate. Maybe we'll contemplate it a bit more a little bit later on in the show. You guys might remember, gosh, I hope you do, it was only a few days ago, Wednesday evening, we spoke to Mark Borchardt, a great guy, a great favorite of so many of our listeners out there. We talked to him about a lot of things, including his featured role in a new film titled Modus Operandi, which I talked about that film a little bit during that segment. It is a film unlike anything you've ever seen before, and I think it's destined to be one of the great cult classics. And it was an official selection at the 2009 CineVegas Film Fest, and it just enjoyed a premiere at the AFI Fest this past Friday.
Oh, cool.
It's a very fascinating film, and the second you view this film, you're going to question yourself. You're going to ask yourself, who made this? And we're going to bring you the guy that made it right now, the writer-director of Modus Operandi, Mr. Frankie Latina. Frankie, are you with us?
Yes, sir.
Hey, how are you, sir?
Welcome.
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
No problem. I really wanted to talk to you. Now, this film, let's try to give our audience an idea of what this film is. One critic said that imagine a James Bond film directed by Ed Wood. Now, do you take that as accurate, as a compliment?
No, I take that as an honor.
Okay. So how do you describe the film to people when they ask you about it?
Well, I've always been in love with art house films and blaxploitation films, so I decided to make an artsploitation film.
Mm. And so there's a lot of different influences going in and out of this. So when you devised it, tell me where you got the idea of the plot. It's essentially about tell our audience a little bit about what the plot of the film.
It's basically a revenge film, and the main character, Stanley Cachet, played by Randy Russell, who starred in Chris Smith's first film, American Job, is like the number one guy at the CIA, and people come to kill him, of course, and he's not home, so of course they kill his wife. He's not there. He goes through a state of depression. He's just a washed-up CIA guy living above a bar in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And CIA has I don't want to give the story away. Obviously, you know what I'm going to get at next. But since you've seen it, anyways, they need him for one last mission. And if he pulls through, they'll give him the name of the man who killed his wife.
Yeah.
Okay.
So when you wrote the script, how did you go about getting it done? It was a long road, wasn't it?
It took us 4 years to make the film, mainly because I would run out of money. It wasn't a lack of effort by any means. It was just no money. You know, if you don't have any money, you can't get film. If you don't have money, you can't get processing, so on and so forth. The script was a bit unconventional. It wasn't your, Sid Field, film school, screenplay. It was, I have, all these books by this guy. His name's Helmut Newton. He's a photographer.
Yeah.
And, I couldn't afford the books, at the bookstore. So, I would buy the books, the Helmut Newton books. and then take them to a photocopy center and then photocopy all my favorite books, photocopy all my favorite pictures,
mm-hmm.
and then take it back to the bookstore, return it, and then get the next book, and then just do that until I had all these different pictures and imagery, and then I would write notes and dialogue underneath each picture. So that's basically how I developed the script.
And you shot this on Super 8 film,
yeah.
correct? Tell me about that format. Is that still? Are there still a lot of great resources for that format? I know of a house or two that I've read that still specializes in it, but.
Yeah, the place that I went through was in Burbank, California, and
mm-hmm.
they do a great job. As far as how many places are still around, like you said, there's a few places that specialize in it, and it doesn't look like it's going anywhere. It doesn't, it looks like it's, still kicking, and people are still using it as more of like a nostalgic, the cheapest, inexpensive way to shoot, to still be able to shoot motion picture film.
Right, right.
That's refreshing.
Were there benefits of shooting Super 8 as opposed to video or digital video or something like that for you in this project?
I'm not a film snob. I don't take anything away from anyone who shoots on video.
Right.
Unfortunately for this project, I didn't think it would do the genre and all the filmmakers and films that I was paying tribute to shoot on video. So
right.
I really wanted to shoot on film, and I couldn't afford 35 and I couldn't afford 16. So I had to shoot on Super 8.
You're from Milwaukee, correct?
Yeah. Yep. Laverne and Shirley, Fonzarelli, Jeffrey Dahmer.
Right.
There we go.
Wow. That's quite a pedigree for Milwaukee there. Tell me about the independent film scene there.
It's something that you can't really put your finger on it. There's all these different, it's just like different factions of different filmmakers in town. They're all so amazing in their own way. They all come. It's funny though. How the filmmakers kind of have like a they have this bravado. They're different groups and cliques, kind of like just in life in general. But
mm-hmm.
In Milwaukee, when someone needs to pool all the resources together, everybody kind of forgets about that for that weekend or that afternoon. And the guy with the fancy lights comes, and the guy with the super 16 camera comes, and you'll get the best sound guy. It's not like LA or New York where there's tons of people and tons of resources and
right.
Lots of equipment. So
right.
Basically everyone comes together and sews together this project, and there's a lot of things that have come out of Milwaukee that I'm very proud of, as far as Christmas American movie, and my cousin shot a movie called The Violinist that I was very proud of, and there's a couple other guys in town, the De Leon brothers, that are working on some things. So,
mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of filmmakers and a lot of enthusiasm. So, just going along for the ride.
Yeah, and it does strike me that people in the community got behind you to support the making of this film. So you still feel that excitement that, we're making a movie and people want to be involved in something like that.
I think the reason they wanted to be involved is so I'd finally be finished and stop asking everyone in town for favors.
Because you shot, you said you've been working on it for 4 years, but that equates to something like over 1,400 shooting days, doesn't it?
Right, yeah. I mean, a lot of people say like, oh, well, my movie takes place in summer, or my movie takes place in fall, or my movie takes place, winter, whatever. If you saw the movie, if you watch it carefully, the seasons change like from scene to scene. And that just means I couldn't afford to shoot the next scene until I got, I got money from a producer and now it's snowing. Well, the last scene was in July. Well, that's just the way it's going to have to be.
And you have to be really dedicated and maintain your passion and your determination when you go through that long process. Did it ever flag for you that passion? Did you ever think of throwing in the towel?
Yeah, I mean, of course. But every time I would get really depressed and down on myself and think that, you know, it was just, you know, just all for naught, I would watch Hearts of Darkness on repeat on my DVD player. I would just put it on and just press repeat in the whole day. I wouldn't obviously sit there like a, you know, like a crazy person and watch it for 12 hours, but it was playing on my TV like constantly. So whenever I would come in the room or I'd leave, I'd come back, it would always be playing on my TV. That was a huge motivation for me, just watching Hearts of Darkness over and over again.
Right.
Yeah, I bet. I think that's probably the most valuable documentary in existence for filmmakers, because it shows them, you know, I don't have it that bad.
Yeah.
Right.
That's a very inspiring movie.
It is.
Right. Don't take my word for it, but anyone out there that's listening, if you can't afford film school, but you can afford $60, the three best documentaries ever made, I think, for my money, Hearts of Darkness, Burden of Dreams, and American Movie. So,
yeah, those,
if you can't afford
all
film
three.
School, just get those three DVDs.
Yeah.
Speaking of movies that inspire you, what are those movies, particularly growing up when you developed a passion for movies? What were those movies that made a difference to you?
I'd say the main films that really made a difference for me for this film would be Female Trouble by John Waters.
Oh, yeah, mm-hmm. Okay.
And then Blue Velvet by David Lynch.
Oh, okay.
Coffee by Jack Hill,
starring
Pam Grier. Apocalypse Now, of course. Pulp Fiction, Les Samurai by Jean-Pierre Melville.
Oh, that's one of the best. I mean, it's amazing the influence that movie still has.
I can't say much enough about that.
Oh, it's
film.
A magnificent film.
And those are filmmakers that continue to inspire you. I would imagine, in terms of David Lynch, I've always wanted to ask a filmmaker their opinion on David Lynch and where his career has gone, if you'll allow me. Because Blue Velvet, obviously a great work of art. Wild at Heart has always been my favorite, one of my favorite films of all time. And Fire Walk with Me, I think, is exceptional. How do you think he's, what is your take on where he's gone with his career now? He's only working digital now. He says he doesn't want to go back to film. It's just too troublesome, he says, with his last film. I can't recall the name of the last film.
Inland Empire.
Right. How do you think of the, what do you think of the maturation of his career?
I mean, after Eraserhead, he had me hooked.
Right.
And then, you know, Blue Velvet, do I even need to, you know, talk about Blue Velvet?
No,
like
no.
Said,
I,
that part. I guess I'm dancing around the question. I think as anyone would around David Lynch's, past few films. I think to be perfectly honest with you, I think he's just. It's going through, you know, a different time in his life, and he's really, really pushing the boundaries of experimental narrative.
Right.
Is that the movie that I want to see from him? No, I want to see, you know, Blue Velvet again. I want to see Wild at Heart. I want to see Eraserhead. Is he gonna make that movie again? Probably not. Is he gonna make something in that style or, you know, that aesthetic that, you know, that really drew me in? Possibly. I don't know. But I do know that he's one of the great, American masters of cinema, and I'm not going to stop paying, my ticket price and getting a bucket of popcorn and sipping on a soda while I'm, you know, watching his next film. So,
amen.
Yeah.
I hope I didn't
dance around that too much.
No, but you bring up a good point because, he's definitely. I mean, Inland Empire. I was talking about it with someone last night. It's a very dense film. It's a hard film to get into. But I want that from him. I want him to, like, you know, keep pushing the envelope as he gets older. You never want anyone to become comfortable.
Yeah, especially David Lynch.
He's never been comfortable. I mean, this is a guy who refuses to go gently into the good night and to make something, you know, I don't think this guy's ever sold out. I don't think he's capable of it.
No. Yeah, that's what's great about him. Yeah. Now, your film, back to your film. Your cast is exceptional in this. And it's headlined, obviously we talked about Mark last week when we spoke to him, but it's headlined by none other than Danny Trejo. Now, where did the idea come to get Danny Trejo involved, and how did you go about doing that?
I've always been a huge fan, obviously, of him and of his work, and I just went out on a whim and called AES, a talent agent?
His agent?
Gloria Hinojosa. Yeah, his agent, Gloria Hinojosa. And, you know, I've never done this before, so, you call up and you think, like, oh, my God, they're going to answer the phone, right? But it's not, of course. It's like a secretary or their assistant. And, you give them your little spiel, like, oh, I'm, you know, making an independent film. I'm interested in having Dan Trejo in the film. And, you know, they ask you, like, okay, what's your budget and you know, this, that, and the other. And, you know, that was it. And they're like, okay, you know, we'll get back to you or whatever. And I never heard back. So then I called a week later. And I tell them again, you know, I ask, you know, for the same person. And, you know, it goes on and on and on. I called five times. And finally, I think just to get me off the phone or for me to stop calling, they put me through to his agent, really nice woman, Gloria Hinojosa. And, and she was like, all right, we'll see what we can do. You're going to have to, talk to SAG and, you know, all that. You know, I was like, oh, my God, like, I have to call SAG up. And my film wasn't even a SAG film, but they have, like, a super low-budget SAG agreement.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she told me, okay, fine, you know, you got your SAG taken care of. And Special Entertainment, one of the executive producers, took care of all the SAG stuff, so I was very appreciative for that. To make a long story short, she gave me the number, the price that we had to pay him, and she was like, have this in his escrow account by Friday, and we'll make it happen. And I told her, yeah, no problem, we have the money, it's not a problem. I hung up the phone with her, and immediately my bank account, I think, was like $33 negative because I bought a sub sandwich, and I had like, you know, like $4.75, but the sub was like $5.37. So, like, I was, like, a few cents short, so then they charged me, like, an additional $30 fee. You know how they do that at the bank?
Yeah.
And so I get off the phone with her, and I know I have no money. So I call up all these producers that have been helping out with the film over the 4 years, and we went to this pizzeria in town, and I printed out pictures of Danny, a close-up of his face and all the movies that he's been in, and I put them all in manila envelopes and put them around the table, and everybody, you know, I knew everyone was just seeing, like, oh, God, what is he gonna, you know, what is he trying to do this time? And, you know, they opened it up, and I said, all right, for X amount of dollars, we can get him in the movie. We need it by Friday. And lo and behold, they just, you know, signed the checks, and we put it in his escrow account and picked him up from the airport and shot him. <soon. laughs>
So when you go to direct to Danny Trejo, what was that like for you, man?
Oh, it was extremely extremely humbling, and I couldn't believe, you know, you never know how these people are going to act because, you know, you see them on TV and everything like that, and you're just like, you know, you have these impressions and, all the stories you've heard about him. But he's like the nicest guy you'll ever meet in your entire life, very gracious and caring and fun on set. I remember one time they were doing the clapper board for the sink, and the guy had his hands up ready to do the clapper board, and Danny was poking the guy in his stomach trying to make him laugh. So just real fun things like that.
That's great. That's great when you hear about them being just genuinely nice people.
It is.
That makes you like them that much more. Now your film just screened at AFI. I know it was a big success at CineVegas this year as well, but how did the AFI screening go? That was Friday, wasn't it?
Yes. It was just really surreal. I was, you know, I'm extremely grateful for AFI, and I'm, you know, so proud that I made it, you know, to Hollywood, California, right? You know, that's like where everybody wants to be, and
yeah.
Walk down the red carpet with Wes Anderson and Bill Murray because they were premiering their new film beforehand, and they have everybody walk down the red carpet at the same time. So it was just really surreal, and I just couldn't believe it. But everyone that came to the film really liked it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a midnight film, so it wasn't like a matinee where the wrong crowd would come in or something like that. So,
is there what's the future for it? How can our audience see it? When do you think they'll be able to watch it for themselves?
Well, right now, my sales agent Josh Braun from Submarine Entertainment is working on some things. So, as soon as we can sell the film and get distribution, we should be in good shape. And in the meantime, you can go to. Do you mind if I say a website?
Please,
oh,
please.
Oh, please do.
Okay. Yeah, in the meantime, you can go to frankielatina.com. It's just frankielatina.com. And you can, you know, check out the website and keep you updated on things. My email's on there as well, so if you need to ask any questions or anything like that, feel free, and I'll get back to you as soon as possible.
Well, I wish you the best of luck with it, man. I just enjoyed the heck out of it, and I appreciate you making it, and I appreciate you coming on and talking all about making it, and want you to come back anytime you'd like in the future.
Yeah.
I really appreciate it, guys. I'm a big fan of your show, so keep up the great work.
Thank you, Frankie. I appreciate it, man. I'll talk to you soon, man.
Okay.
All right, take care, guys.
You
okay,
too.
Bye-bye.
Ciao.
That's Frankie Latina. The movie is Modus Operandi. Go to frankielatina.com. For updates, the latest details about how you'll be able to see the film, and read all the reviews of it. I mean, critical raves, and it's a very unique film. And like I said on Wednesday night, I think I said something like it's a movie that's drunk on film. I think
those are the exact words you used.
I think that's appropriate. So movie geeks like us, it's irresistible.
It's a good film.
Absolutely. All right, Jerry, any more movie news that we needed to cover before we close off tonight?
We covered everything this week.
Let me just say, I'm not just a movie geek, I'm a football fan. And Brett Favre just beat the hell out of the Green Bay Packers. Thank you very much.
My team didn't play this week, which is probably for the best.
Yeah, I think so, too.
Hey,
my team didn't play either. So the Bucks or the Redskins, they don't play.
You haven't lived until you get your latest issue of Rolling Stone, and they normally don't have sports articles. And when the sports article is the wreckage of a team, and it's about your host, Daniel Snyder, yeah, it's embarrassing.
Oh, that's great. That's great stuff. Answer my question. You said the Guy Ritchie about Mission Impossible 4. We're about to play our mystery movie song of the show, but before we do that, Guy Ritchie would be a good fit for Mission Impossible, you think?
I think so. I think his style and everything, definitely.
Really? You think Guy Ritchie is stylistically is more in tune with Mission Impossible than a Merchant Ivory?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah,
why?
Okay.
Merchant Ivory?
I don't think they're in the running for it, personally. Yeah.
No, I don't think so. If
you look at other collaborators of Tom Cruise in his past, would Paul Thomas Anderson make an interesting Mission Impossible?
He would definitely make an interesting Mission Impossible. It would be a very Altman-esque Mission Impossible. But he would, because let's be honest, you know, when we first heard the news about Punch Drunk Love, I think everyone was a little bit bewildered, and we were just blown away by the results, so...
Right.
I wouldn't rule out PTA. I think if you know, tomorrow I read PTA was the choice, I'd be like, wow, that's going to be the best Mission Impossible film ever.
Yeah, it would definitely raise expectations. It would
be more
of a curious project. Than
I'd be camping out right now if that was the case. But
yeah, a James Cameron.
Oh, wow.
Or is he bigger than Mission Impossible?
That's,
he's not really a director for hire anymore. I mean,
you
can't.
Think he would, you honestly think he would even consider it?
I tell you, he might consider it if he doesn't still feel so burned by the War of the Worlds time when Tom Cruise went crazy. Spielberg might actually. I think Spielberg would probably be a top choice for a Mission Impossible movie only because he's always been dying to do a James Bond.
Oh, I wouldn't rule him out. And, you know, I love his War of the Worlds, regardless of the baggage that comes with that. So I would definitely, I would welcome a Spielberg on a Mission
Impossible. No, I wasn't commenting on the quality of the movie War of the Worlds.
Yeah.
I was just,
I'm
pretty sure it was apparent he was frustrated at that time.
Oh, if there's a tent that, like, you know, those tents or whatever that were on the set.
Yeah.
No, but regardless of that, no, Spielberg is a perfect choice. I mean, if Spielberg did Mission Impossible 4, oh, my God, that'd be incredible.
Yeah, that would be a good one. Anyone but Michael Bay. By the way, speaking of Michael Bay, I did see Transformers 2 last week. I was having health issues and last week, and my arm was hurting, and my mind always goes in places like, oh, my God. I wonder if I'm going to have a heart attack. And I happened to have put in Transformers 2, and halfway through watching it, I was thinking, is this the last movie I'm going to see before I die? Is this really what I'm doing to myself?
Oh, God.
I feel like a moron because I didn't understand it.
All right, let me just say this, because I think Chris went overboard and Jason went overboard, too. It's junk food.
Right.
But and let me say this, because I've been thinking about this a lot lately. It's junk food. No one's going to put this film up for any kind of awards. I'm sure Razzie, so. But you need films like this because it makes you appreciate the good films. Okay? Can I say that? But you
Michael Bay is doing a public service by making
But let me say this, though. It's junk food. That's what it is. It's a movie like G.I. Joe based on a toy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have high expectations going into it.
Exactly. It's based on a toy, and I didn't understand it.
Well, I don't know if there's much to understand, but I can understand that because there's a lot of images, a lot of flashy and crappy editing and all that. But
there's too much like
it is overkill. The movie is a lesson in overkill.
And there's too much going on into their motivation, what they're trying to achieve. The characters. I didn't understand what the whole journey was. The first Transformers. It was
film. Too much thought, Jamie. It's a movie based on a toy. It's what we said. It's really aimed for that demographic, that late teens, early 20s demographic.
Right.
It is what it is. I mean, it's junk food. It's everything. I have this feeling though. In 2 weeks. After 2012 comes out, then people will be praising Transformers 2. Okay?
It could be.
I'm just going to end with that. I'm going to shut up now.
Yeah, I also saw Duplicity, which I enjoyed. It wasn't the cat's meow, but I enjoyed it.
No, it wasn't the cat's meow. That's a problem. It should be the cat's meow. That's a problem. It has all this great energy behind it, and it's good, but I think it should be great, you know? That's just me.
Yeah, it seemed Tony Gilroy doing, you know, kind of a piffle of a movie, and he needs to do more than that. Even if it's a comedic espionage thriller, it felt too small for him.
That's true. That's a good way to look at it.
And too small for the people involved.
Yeah.
I thought it was fine. Okay, what was our mystery movie song last time, Jerry?
Is that a trick question?
No. It was pre-Jamie's birthday.
I know it was pre-Jamie's birthday. It was a Barry Manilow song.
Of course.
But I don't remember the exact title. But I do know it was Barry Manilow. That I know.
It was Can't Smile Without You, man.
Wait, what
can't
was that?
Can't Smile Without You.
I thought you said Can't Smell Without You.
I can't smell it. Barry Manilow's I Can't Smell Anything. I have a huge nose and I still can't smell anything. No, that's from Hellboy 2. It's from a lot of different movies.
I remember that scene from Hellboy 2, and I thought that was very nice that you picked that, because you know I like that movie. I thought it was very cool.
Yeah, because when you think Manilow, you think Guillermo del Toro.
I never think of anything else.
It's automatic.
Yeah.
All right. So here's, you know, Barry Manilow's a favorite of mine. This next gentleman that we're going to play a song from is my other favorite, oddly enough. And this is from a movie. It's from his movie that we're going to close off tonight's show with. We'll be back I'm guessing we'll be back next week.
Okay.
Talk about whatever we talk about, whatever there is to talk about. And then in 2 weeks, we'll be back with an inside, no, the new classics, a celebration of Boogie Nights, speaking of PTA.
Mm-hmm.
No, you're looking forward to that one.
Oh, you know I am.
All right. Here's our movie song of the show. See you guys next time. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Shut up already. Damn. Tell me who in this house know about the quake. I mean, relax, relax. If you know how to rock, say yeah.
Yeah.
If you know how to party, say oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
But if you ain't hip to the rare house quake, shut up already. Damn. House quake. Everybody jump up and down. House quake. Oh, there's a brand new groove. Anybody know about the quake?
Shut up already. Damn.